Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Charlotte Gill, and she's a widely published comment journalist, and you can read her writing in The Telegraph, in The Mail on Sunday, and of course The Critic. She addresses a wide range of topics, from the war on cars to devolution. And she has a Substack called Gill's Quill, where she specifically looks a lot at woke waste and that sort of thing. So something that Charlotte's been really good at is looking into the funding of absolutely bizarre, bonkers papers and research projects in universities. And they're the sorts of things that when they get reported in the Daily Mail, nobody thinks they're real, but they are. So hello, Charlotte. And I was wondering if you could perhaps sort of kick off by telling us about some of the projects that you've dug into.
Hi, Joe. Well, thanks very much for having me on the podcast. Delighted to be here. So it actually started off in quite a random way. I was writing news stories for The Telegraph, mainly sort of about my own interests in writing, trying to pitch the publishing industry. And finding that, to add the caveat that I don't think I have the divine right to be published, but I just noticed that there was a lot of woke capture within that sector, and that you were definitely being judged through the lens of identity. And it sounds a bit tangential, but it led me to looking into other things that had woke capture in them. I kept finding lots of rabbit holes, and then things to do with government funding would come up, and long story short, a lot of random rabbit holes, I ended up looking at the UKRI. And I think most people won't actually, I mean, to be honest, I didn't really know much.
I was gonna say, I have no idea what that stands for. Do you mind spelling it out?
Yeah, it's so it stands for UK Research and Innovation, and I think it says something that people like ourselves that love, without sounding terribly self, you know, we love politics, we love reading about this stuff, we don't really know what it is. So I don't think most people around the country would really have much of an idea. I mean, I was looking into, there was a study, I think it was about non-binary identity in higher education, and I was having a little nose around what the researchers had done, other projects, and it led me to the UKRI and a study about pregnant men. and I thought, what the hell am I looking at? And I just began searching. So UK Research and Innovation is essentially a non-governmental public body. So last year, Rishi Sunak set up the Department for Science, Innovation and Technology, and they give the UKRI $8 billion each year. And the idea when it was set up is that they're going to, you know, they're the best decision makers on science and innovation. It's best for the government to consolidate this area and give them the powers to decide which projects best deserve investment. So $8 billion a year. And don't get me wrong, a lot of it does go to really important scientific projects. So I think that's important to add that note in before digging into the nonsense. But some of the stuff just coming out from it, taxpayers, I mean, they were astonished when I started showing people. The UKRI essentially is an umbrella organization. It has 9 subsidiaries, councils underneath it. So one, for instance, is the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Then there's the Economic and Social Research Council. And these ones have some of the most egregious in terms of woke funding. And I mean, it was difficult to know whether to laugh or cry. The names of the studies, people, it's the sort of thing you'd spit out your food, you know, if you were, well, bad example, but, you know, like you go, what? If someone told you over dinner, or like, you know, just, it's just really shocking. So I've got some examples here. The one that really caught people was the Europe that gay porn built, 1945 to 2000. And that was, I believe it was an Arts and Humanities Research Council. So they gave it, 840,000, £830 for this cutting edge research into, so the abstract reads, how did the growing transnational circulation of gay, male erotica and porn magazines in post-war Europe contribute to the development of a shared identity and sense of belonging among European gay men? And that is, I can't remember how long that study's for, but it's just a bit, just not what people expect, is it?
So you've got to ask sort of what good that's doing on any sort of practical level, and I that sounds ridiculous. And what's been the reaction? Because I saw on social media that you've had a bit of kickback, and there have been some sort of attempts to slur you, and indeed anyone who questions this, as sort of anti-intellectual and sort of, knee-jerk and bigoted. What has been the response that you've had?
It was interesting. So what I did first of all is I took, I don't want to say the most crazy examples because I haven't even finished looking through all of them. I mean, it was just a sample and I posted them on social media. So at first, the reaction was quite positive in the sense that it was getting traction in the way I wanted, people being shocked that this is happening, raising awareness, because what I'd like to achieve one day is for this not to have money spent on it. Then there was almost like a second wave of reactions, and that was from the academic community. When it really started to get major traction, I began to get a lot of pushback. Professors, doctors, people. Yeah, I was accused of anti-intellectualism. One was because I did choose a poor example. One of them I put up was about the grain trade, and people said, hey, that's actually very important. Fair enough. But other examples were pretty crazy. A lot of the academics were just focusing on the grain trade one to sort of diminish my other points. And then people were replying, but still look at all these other crazy ones. But they just got, they got really personal, anti-intellectual, grifter is the word that seems to be coming up a massive amount on
projection.
The thing is, like, if we ever said it about why are we paying for this nonsense, we'd probably get sued, it'd be libelous, but it seems fine when you're criticizing journalists to accuse them of being grifters. Huge pushback, lots of insults, and then I sort of decided a bit to go on the offense and started tweeting back at them, and it sort of quietened down a little bit. One really interesting thing was, when it was happening, this Finnish chap reached out to me, and he's an engineer, and he said, I did this in Finland, exposing really strange studies. And he said that the reaction was exactly the same. And it also created a bit of a government crisis. The government were having to defend some of these projects. And then he said that the academics were also behaving in the same way and also acting as if they'd been sort of put in danger. And I was quite, one of the most interesting responses I had was that academics pretty much on day one of the time they came for me were making out as if I'd exposed loads of innocent young students, putting their details all online so that they could be doxxed. And that was deceitful in a number of ways. Like, number one, there was no evidence that happened, and they were saying it almost immediately. Number two, I published a vast amount, and the focus was really the titles. It wasn't like, look at this person who wrote it. And number three, students are adults. They are not they're making out that they were, you know, oh, they just got that, they're so innocent, these people, they're using taxpayer money. One student, for instance, is investigating. So this is a studentship and they get paid 19,000 basic income, and then they get about 4,700 on top in tuition fees. That's a minimum per year. Obviously, that's not a great salary, but it's still taxpayers' money, and every penny is taxpayers allowed to ask about. And this researcher is studying asexual epidemics, detectives and spinsters, the construction of pathological asexuality in Victorian fiction. And I know, it's mad. And I just think we're allowed to interrogate these studies. There was even one academic that replied about, oh, we get barely anything and it's so hard for us. And people sort of said, get a real job. You know, it's tough, but don't study things that don't contribute to the economy. Oh, and the other one, this isn't actually a studentship, but I brought out one of the other really ridiculous ones I found, which is cuteness in contemporary environmental culture, developing eco-poetic practice. I know, and it's actually got some of the funniest, the abstract has some of the funniest lines in it.
You go ahead.
So it begins, encountering cute animals from bunnies to kittens, monkeys to hedgehogs, is an everyday experience for most of us. They appear on tea towels, cakes, and videos gone viral on social media. The cute animal might even be our pet. The simple, benign nature of cuteness means it goes unexamined, especially in the context of the environmental crisis, where the aesthetic is likely to appear irrelevant, if not irreverent. This project overturns such thinking by asking, can cuteness prompt caregiving behavior for environments? What power dynamics exist in the cutification of animals? What fate for uncute species? And then, oh, and then it gets even, oh, and also it will allow the researcher who's been given £120,000, it will allow her to establish an eco-poetic community of young writers via eco-poetry workshops and an international competition that includes mentoring as its prize. Yeah, and it's awful.
There was an entire book on the whole kawaii cute phenomenon, wasn't there? It's even not even like it's new ground.
I mean, it's I know. It's mad. I particularly like she put I won't read much more of it, I think, but she put eco poetry often recounts awestruck rather than awestruck reactions to nature. It's like what?
God, oh, that's priceless. And so you mentioned that you've been contacted from you were contacted by somebody from Finland. Is this happening across? I mean, I've come across examples in the States, but is it happening across Europe more widely, across the west of the world, or does it seem to be like an Anglosphere thing?
My guess would be that it is an Anglosphere thing. I think one line of inquiry that might be quite a good indicator of how this, like, where this area lies is, you know, the gender equality paradox, and this idea that, so there's an idea that the more gender equal a society does, the more women veer away from STEM subjects, for instance, because they're more you know, there's more liberation in the society to sort of follow your dreams and do what you want to do, rather than where a society will typically think demand in the economy for skills lies. I think the more progressed and developed Western societies have become, the more indulgent and sort of Judith Butlerified they've become in their pursuits of subjects. It's quite a decadent thing to look into things that aren't really necessary for jobs.
It is, but it also kind of strikes me as that's where the pushback could come from. You know, if there was a genuine diversity of thought and opinion within the humanities, then that could be the sort of the crucible for the resistance, if you like. It just seems such a shame that there's this pernicious groupthink that seems to have descended.
Yeah, it really is a groupthink. And even the reactions of academics wasn't what one would expect from academics, because universities are meant to be a place of constant disagreement and interrogation. And actually they're doing everything that a university shouldn't do in terms of making people very illiberal and authoritarian. So they do react when you, I just didn't find the reactions. You don't imagine, say, Socrates, that he would have behaved like that when someone, the examined life versus unexamined, and why was that so threatening? They could have responded. Yeah, it just looked quite suspicious. I actually forgot to read some of the Finnish chap. I don't actually know if some of his studies were even worse than mine. So one of them was called The Politics of Public Excrement in Cityscape Art and Bioethics. And that was given 250,000 euros in taxpayer fund. And then one was called Emotions, Female Identities and Non-Normative Sexuality During the Catholic Reformation in France. And then there was LGBTQI+ and Street Level Bureaucrats Assessing Motives, Violence and Opportunities for Collective Advocacy in East Africa. Price. 570,000 euros.
Oh my God. I mean, yes, I suspect there are probably more pressing problems in East Africa, but yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, who's offering the funding? Because I understand you said the sort of UKRI sort of behind a lot of it, but presumably there's also, is there private funding as well from international bodies, or is that
not on? Most of the funding I've found is UKRI through its subsidiaries, and the worst examples I've found so far have tended to be Economic and Social Research Council and the Arts and Humanities Research Council, but the UKRI, it has some other ways. Like, it's got this Future Leaders Award, which is very diversity focused, in that it's really based on, you know, the precedent for it is immutable characteristics, particularly racially. You know, it seems to primarily be looking for those factors rather than the actual research itself. And I saw that they'd given to decolonizing gender violence in higher education project. They've given about £1 million so far. But the other names that come up sometimes in research are trusts. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to name them because there's so much here that I haven't even got through like a tenth of it. So I'm yet to come to trusts in great detail, but I do think that's quite interesting. And I don't want to say which ones I've seen without knowing a bit more.
Okay, fair enough. I won't push you on that, but I am curious. So, I mean, it seems to be dribbling out of universities, and, you know, obviously we've seen it all over the place in statutory bodies and all the rest of it, but it really does seem to be the cultural sector, and you mentioned publishing at the start there, but museums, sort of. Last time I went to the Pitt Rivers, one of my favourite museums, I've noticed that they'd sort of started queer washing the exhibits, which was infuriating. Why do you think the cultural sector sort of more broadly seems to be so weak on this? Why is it so easily sort of washed across it?
Yeah, it's really strange. And it's interesting what you say about the queer washing, because it almost seems like overnight everyone just decided queer is now the word of the millennium almost. And if you, you know, there's so many UKRI studies that have queer in the title. I was actually looking for sober events in London because I'm teetotal. And the first one I found on Club Soda, that's probably one of the most famous drinking places, was queer beers. I thought, what's going on? I think there's definitely a funding aspect to it. For instance, the Arts Council England sets, it has a financial, it has investment principles. It has four in total. Two are designed, they're basically like, is it good? Are we going to enjoy it? And then the other two, one is environmentalism and one is diversity. So that financially incentivizes artists. They're asked to prove, you know, the Arts Council even says, we'd be interested to see how you're achieving these goals when we consider your funding application. So that it financially incentivizes them. And actually, it's quite hilarious how some of these artists are trying to achieve it, because you say to the, especially on the environmental lines, you think about an artist trying to get funding, they're thinking, Christ, like, how am I going to prove, you know, I'm not going to build a carbon capture machine. And one of the funniest examples I saw was this chap. He had a dance show, and I don't even know if he was a chap. He was non-binary, I think. And it was about a dancer who converts their dance moves into renewable energy. I know. And I just thought, at first I thought, this is ridiculous. But then I thought, poor guy, like, was this just him trying to get funding by showing that he's hit that environment goal? So I think that that's a massive issue, because obviously these areas are very ideological now. I do think that artists can be quite conformist, which is really depressing. Because obviously one would hope, I mean, they are convinced that they're the most liberal, open-minded sector. But this is a huge paradox, because they become very conformist and liberal. I think there's one thing. I mean, recently I wrote an article about what I call the low information voter. And historically, people have used that to describe the gammons and the Brexiteers, the people that fell for Trump. They didn't have enough information. But I find that in general, it seems to be, it's like the more educated liberal class, actually the low information voter. And I think they get to a point where there might be an element of the fact that they've gone to higher education, and they sort of think, well, I'm done, you know, I'm qualified in life. And then they start to rely on sound bites rather than really examining. So for instance, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, but like Sadiq Khan, for instance, he says about ULEZ, he says, we're saving children's lungs. And the people I see most power at that are educated, sort of trendy liberals. And it's almost as if, because they're all in the same socioeconomic group, they use that fact that they're in it together, that cohort, as verification that what one of their members is saying is correct. But then you find that some people, the sort of school of life, can be some of the most educated and, you know the most about what's going on with policies. And I think there's an element of, in the arts sector, it just seems a bit brainless. It seems like one, you know, if they're being told people are non-binary, they'll just go along with it. There's a real herd mentality, and I think they're so
the arts, really, isn't it? You expect, you know, they're there to be challenged, they're to put forward a counter narrative, to be anti-establishment, and essentially they are the establishment, aren't they?
It's scary, they really are. And I think the only good thing that might happen is, I mean, they are going bust. People don't want to see some of this art. There was that, for instance, there was a Me Too film out a few years ago, and it was, I think it had Carey Mulligan in it. See, I don't even remember what it was called, and it just sunk at the box office because people don't want to see another film that's a parable for the pillars of woke. You know, not saying, I mean, everyone knows Me Too, what, like, Harvey Weinstein was a horrible, man, but they just don't want to see more. It's just, all of the art has just become so moralistic, you know. It's like living in a religious society. You just don't want that. And I think hopefully they'll go, but the thing is that they are already going bust, but they want more. They always want more money. They're getting 445 million from the taxpayer through the Arts Council England per year. But you're always hearing, oh, it's never enough. Arts is on its knees. We need more money. And these people across all areas, nothing is ever enough. And the more you give them, the more they want.
I mean, have you got any thoughts sort of on that? I mean, you know, how do you think this will play out?
I think it'll be ugly, to be honest. I think, well, the gender, you know, women such as yourself, like the gender critical space is sort of leading the way. I think things that were very difficult to say a few years ago are now a lot easier. You know, people are much more, and it's becoming cooler. You know, it's quite cool to, you know, I'm not the first to say that there's a sort of punk element of the gender critical movement. And I think the more young women start to say, hang on, like, I know her, she's cool and she's saying this, the more there'll be like a movement away generally, breaking up the group thing. I think people, part of why I'm doing the Woke Waste series is because I think it all has to be drawn out into the light. I think people just don't have a clue. Government's so opaque. You know, the benefit of these quangos like and the UKRI and all these little bodies hiding about is that no one is actually seeing what their money's going on, and moreover that it's being used to perpetuate pernicious ideologies and things that are actually actively against the UK citizen. I think more exposure there. I think it'll get nasty in the sense that the people that have had this money and are being exposed will scream harder and harder as people start to challenge it. And I also think the fact that the government has given it in the first place, created these bodies, and that we're about to get a Labour government by all the looks of things is a little bit terrifying, because you're getting to the point where the taxpayer's really going to say, I want a bloody refund for all this crap. And just not, and even feel just completely detached from central government, as if, like, you know, you guys, if you go and do that and we'll go live in the real world. It's getting to that point, the split across so many areas. So I don't know. I mean, there's going to be something, a break. There's going to have to be a massive reformation in order to sort it out.
No, I agree. And thank you so much for your time. Very much appreciate it. Was there anything else you wanted to cover that perhaps I didn't ask you about?
I don't think so. Just that, they're just all joined up. You know, if you look at the war on cars, local government, arts, there's so many parallels. And also, if anyone's listening and wants to give me any tips, I'm always really interested to hear that. So yeah, and they can just drop me an email on my Substack, because there's always new areas to explore. So yeah,
thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.